tilts his flashlight into my eyes again. I lift my arm to my eyes, squinting against the dazzle.
You wouldn't want to get into any trouble.
He says it lightly, but for a moment I think I hear something hard running under his words, a current of anger or aggression. But then I tell myself I'm just being paranoid. No matter what the regulators do, they exist for our protection, for our own good. The regulators sweep away in a group around me, so for a few seconds I'm caught up in a tide of rough shoulders and cotton jackets, unfamiliar cologne and sweat smells. Walkie-talkies sputter to life and fade away again around me. I catch snippets of words and broadcasts. Market Street. A girl and a boy. Possibly infected. Unapproved music on St. Lawrence. Someone appears to be dancing. I get bumped side to side against arms and chests and elbows until finally the group passes and I'm spit out again, left alone on the street as the regulator's footsteps grow more distant behind me. I wait until I can no longer hear the fuzz of their radio chatter or their boots hitting the pavement. Then I take off, feeling again a lifting sensation in my chest, that same sense of happiness and freedom. I can't believe how easy it was to get out of the house. I never knew I could lie to my aunt. I never knew I could lie, period. And when I think about how narrowly I escaped getting grilled by the regulators for hours, it makes me want to jump up and down and pump my fist in the air. Tonight the whole world is on my side, and I'm only a few minutes from Back Cove. My heart picks up its rhythm as I think about skidding down the sloping hill of grass, seeing Alex framed against the last dazzling rays of sun, as I think about that single word breathed into my ear. Gray. I tear down Baxter, which loops around the last mile down to Back Cove, and then I stop short. The buildings have fallen away behind me, giving way to ramshackle sheds sparsely situated on either side of the cracked and run-down road. Beyond that, a short strip of tall, weedy grass slants down toward the cove. The water is an enormous mirror, tipped with pink and gold from the sky. In that single, blazing moment as I come around the bend, the sun, curved over the dip of the horizon like a solid gold archway, lets out its final winking rays of light, shattering the darkness of the water, turning everything white for a fraction of a second, and then falls away, sinking, dragging the pink and the red and the purple out of the sky with it, all the color bleeding away instantly and leaving only dark. Alex was right. It was gorgeous. One of the best I've ever seen. For a moment, I can't move or do anything but stand there, breathing hard, staring. Then a numbness creeps over me. I'm too late. The regulators must have been wrong about the time. It must be after 8:30 now. Even if Alex decides to wait for me somewhere along the long loop of the cove, I don't have a prayer of finding him and making it home before curfew. My eyes sting and the world in front of me goes watery, colors and shapes sloshing together. For a second, I think I must be crying, and I'm so startled I forget everything. Forget about my disappointment and frustration. Forget about Alex standing on the beach, the thought of his hair catching the dying rays of sun, flashing copper. I can't remember the last time I cried. It's been years. I wipe my eyes with the back of my hand, and my vision sharpens again. It's just sweat, I realize, relieved. I'm sweating. It's getting in my eyes. Still, the sick, leaden feeling won't work its way out of my stomach. I stay there for a few minutes, straddling my bike, squeezing the handlebars hard until I'm a little bit calmer. Part of me wants to say, screw it, to shove off, both legs extended, and go flying down the hill toward the water with the wind whipping up my hair. Screw curfew, screw the regulators, screw everyone. But I can't. I couldn't. I could never. I have no choice. I have to get home. I maneuver my bike around in a clumsy circle and start back up the street. Now that the adrenaline and excitement have faded, my legs feel like they're made out of iron and I'm panting before I've gone a quarter of a mile. This time I'm careful to stay alert for regulators and police and patrols. On the way home, I tell myself that it's probably for the best. I must be crazy. Zooming around in the half-dark just to meet up with some guy on the beach. Besides, everything has been explained. He works at the labs, probably just snuck in on evaluation day for some completely innocent reason, to use the bathroom or refill his water bottle. And I remind myself that I probably imagined the whole thing. The message, the meeting up. He's probably sitting in his apartment somewhere doing coursework for his classes. He's probably already forgotten about the two girls he met at the lab complex today. He's probably just being nice earlier, making casual conversation. It's for the best. But no matter how many times I repeat it, the strange, hollow feeling in my stomach doesn't go away. And ridiculous as it is, I can't shake the persistent, needling feeling that I've forgotten something, or missed something, or lost something forever. Chapter 7. Of all the systems of the body, neurological, cognitive, special, sensory, the cardiological system is the most sensitive and easily disturbed. The role of society must be to shelter these systems from infection and decay, or else the future of the human race is at stake. Like a summer fruit that is protected from insect invasion, bruising, and rot by the whole mechanism of modern farming, so must we protect the heart. The Role and Purpose of Society, The Book of Shh, page 353. I was named after Mary Magdalene, who was nearly killed from love. So infected with deliria and in violation of the pacts of society, she fell in love with men who would not have her or could not keep her. Book of Lamentations, Mary, 13:1. We learned all about it in biblical science. First there was John, then Matthew, then Jeremiah and Peter and Judas, and many other nameless men in between. Her last love, they say, was the greatest, a man named Joseph. A bachelor all his life who found her on the street, bruised and broken and half crazy from deliria. There's some debate about what kind of man Joseph was, whether he was righteous or not, whether he ever succumbed to the disease, but in any case, he took good care of her. He nursed her to health and tried to bring her peace. By this time, however, it was too late. She was tormented by her past, haunted by the loves lost and damaged and ruined by the evils she had inflicted on others and that others had inflicted on her. She could hardly eat. She wept all day. She clung to Joseph and begged him never to leave her, but couldn't find comfort in his goodness. And then, one morning, she woke and Joseph was gone, without a word or an explanation. This final abandonment broke her at last, and she fell to the ground, begging God to put her out of her misery. He heard her prayers, and in his infinite compassion, he instead removed from her the curse of deliria, with which all humans had been burdened as punishment for the original sin of Eve and Adam. In a sense, Mary Magdalene was the very first cured. And so, after years of tribulation and pain, she walked in righteousness and peace until the end of her days. Book of Lamentations, Mary 13:1. I always thought it was strange that my mother named me Magdalena. She didn't even believe in the cure. That was her whole problem. And the Book of Lamentations is all about the dangers of deliria. I've done a lot of thinking about it, and in the end, I guess I've figured out that despite everything, my mother knew that she was wrong. That the cure and the procedure were for the best. I think even then she knew what she was going to do. She knew what would happen. I guess my name was her final gift to me, in a way. It was a message. I think she was trying to say, forgive me. I think she was trying to say, someday even this pain will be taken away. You see, no matter what everyone says, and despite everything, I know she wasn't all bad. The next 2 weeks are the busiest of my life. Summer explodes into Portland. In early June, the heat was there, but not the color. The greens were still pale and tentative. The mornings had a biting coolness. But by the last week of school, everything is technicolor and splash. Outrageous blue skies and purple thunderstorms and ink-black night skies and red flowers as bright as spots of blood. Every day after school, there's an assembly or ceremony or graduation party to go to. Hannah gets invited to all of them. I get invited to most, which surprises me. Harlow Davis, who lives with Hannah in the West End and whose father does something for the government, invites me to come over for a casual goodbye thing. I didn't even think she knew my name. Whenever she's talking to Hannah, her eyes have always skated past me like I'm not worth focusing on. I go anyway. I've always been curious about her house, and it turns out to be as spectacular as I imagined. Her family has a car, too, and electric appliances everywhere that obviously get used every day. Washers and dryers and huge chandeliers filled with dozens and dozens of light bulbs. Harlow has invited most of the graduating class. There are 67 of us in total, and probably 50 at the party, which makes me feel less special, but it's still fun. We sit in the backyard while the housekeeper runs in and out of the house with plates and plates of food, coleslaw and potato salad and other barbecue stuff. And her father turns out spare ribs and hamburgers on the enormous smoking grill. I eat until I feel like I'm about to burst and have to roll backward onto the blanket I'm sharing with Hannah. We stay there until almost curfew, when the stars are peeking through a curtain of dark blue and the mosquitoes rise up all at once and we all go shrieking and laughing back into the house, slapping them away. Afterward, I think it's one of the nicest days I've had in a long time. Even girls I don't really like Shelley Pearson, who has hated me since sixth grade when I won the science fair and she took second place, start being nice. I guess it's because we all know the end is close. Most of us won't see one another after graduation, and even if we do, it will be different. We'll be different. We'll be adults, cured, tagged and labeled and paired and identified and placed neatly on our life path, perfectly round marbles set to roll down even well-defined slopes. Teresa Grass turns 18 before school ends and gets cured. So does Morgan Dell. They're absent for a few days and come back to school just before graduation. The change is amazing. They seem peaceful now, mature and somehow remote, like they're encased in a thin layer of ice. Only 2 weeks ago, Teresa's nickname was Teresa Gross, and everyone made fun of her for slouching and chewing on the ends of her hair and generally being a mess. But now she walks straight and tall with her eyes fixed straight in front of her, her lips barely curled in a smile, and everyone shifts a little in the halls so she can pass easily. Same thing goes for Morgan. It's like all their anxiety and self-consciousness has been removed along with the disease. Even Morgan's legs have stopped trembling. Whenever she used to have to speak in class, the trembling would get so bad it would rock the desk. But after the procedure, just like that, whoosh, the shaking stops. Of course, they're not the first girls in our class to get cured. Eleanor Rana and Annie Hahn were both cured way back in the fall, and half a dozen other girls have had the procedure this past semester. But in them, the difference is somehow more pronounced. I keep going with my countdown. 81 days, then 80, then 79. Willow Marks never comes back to school. Rumors filter back to us that she had her procedure and it turned out fine. That she had her procedure and now her brain is going haywire and they're talking about committing her to the crypts, Portland's combo prison and mental ward. That she ran away to the wilds. Only one thing is for sure. The whole Marks family is under constant surveillance now. The regulators are blaming Mr. and Mrs. Marks, and the whole extended family, for not instilling in her a proper education. And only a few days after she was supposedly found in Deering Oaks Park, I overhear my aunt and uncle whispering that both of Willow's parents have been fired from their jobs. A week later, we hear that they've had to move in with a distant relative. Apparently, people kept throwing rocks at their windows, and a whole side of their house was written over with a single word. Sympathizers. It makes no sense, because Mr. and Mrs. Marks were on record insisting that their daughter have the procedure early, despite the risks. But as my aunt says, people get like that when they're scared. Everyone is terrified that the delirium will somehow find its way into Portland on a large scale. Everyone wants to prevent an epidemic. I feel bad for the Marks family, of course, but that's the way things are. It's like the regulators. You may not like the patrols and the identity checks, but since you know it's all done for your protection, it's impossible not to cooperate. And it may sound awful, but I don't think about Willow's family for long. There's just too much end of high school paperwork to file and nervous energy and lockers to clean out and final exams to take and people to say goodbye to. Hannah and I can barely find time to run together. When we do, we stick to our old routes by a silent agreement. She never mentions the afternoon at the labs again, to my surprise. But Hannah's mind has a tendency to skip around. And her new obsession is a collapse at the northern end of the border that people are saying might have been caused by invalids. I don't even consider going down to the labs again, not for one single solitary second. I focus on everything and anything besides my lingering questions about Alex. Which isn't too hard, considering that I now can't believe I spent an evening biking up and down the streets of Portland, lying to Carol and the regulators, just to meet up with him. The very next day, it felt like a dream. Or a delusion. I tell myself I must have gone temporarily insane. Brain scramble from running in the heat. On graduation day, Hannah sits three rows ahead of me at the commencement ceremony. As she files past me to take her seat, she reaches out for my hand. Two long pumps, two short ones. And when she sits down, she tilts her head back so I can see that she has taken a marker and scrawled on the top of her graduation cap. Thank God! I stifle a laugh, and she turns around and makes a pretend stern face at me. All of us are giddy, and I've never felt closer to the St. Anne's girls than that day. All of us sweating under the sun, which beams down on us like an exaggerated smile, fanning ourselves with the commencement brochures, trying not to yawn or roll our eyes while Principal McIntosh drones on about adulthood and our entrance into the community order, nudging one another and tugging on the collars of our scratchy graduation gowns to try to let some air down our necks. Family members sit in white plastic folding chairs under a cream-white tarp fluttering with flags. The school flag, the city flag, the state flag, the American flag. They applaud politely as each graduate goes up to receive her diploma. When it's my turn, I scan the audience looking for my aunt and my sister, but I'm so nervous about tripping and falling as I take my place on the stage and reach for the diploma in Principal McIntosh's hand. I can't see anything but color. Green, blue, white, a mess of pink and brown faces, or make out any individual sounds beyond the shush of clapping hands. Only Hannah's voice, loud and clear as a bell. Hallelujah, Helena! That's our special pump-you-up chant that we used to do before track meets and tests. A combination of both of our names. Afterward, we line up to take individual portraits with our diplomas. An official photographer has been hired, and a royal blue backdrop set up in the middle of the soccer field where we all stand and pose. We're too excited to take the picture seriously, though. People keep doubling over laughing in their pictures, so all you can see is the crown of their heads. When it's my turn for a picture, at the very last second, Hannah jumps in and throws one arm around my shoulders, and the photographer is so startled he presses down on the shutter anyway. Click. There we are. I'm turning to Hannah, mouth open, surprised, about to laugh. She's a full head taller than me, has her eyes shut and her mouth open. I really do think there was something special about that day. Something golden and maybe even magic. Because even though my face was all red and my hair looked sticky on my forehead, it's like Hannah rubbed off on me a little bit. Because despite everything and just in that one picture, I look pretty. More than pretty. Beautiful, even. The school band keeps playing, mostly in tune, and the music floats across the field and is echoed by the birds wheeling in the sky. It's like something lifts in that moment, some huge pressure or divide. And before I know what's happening, all my classmates are crushing together in a huge hug, jumping up and down and screaming, "We did it! We did it! We did it!" And none of the parents or teachers try to separate us. As we start to break away, I see them encircling us, watching with patient expressions, hands folded. I catch my aunt's gaze and my stomach does a weird twist, and I know that she, like everyone else, is giving us this moment. Our last moment together, before things change for good and forever. And things will change, are changing even at that second. As the group dissolves into clumps of students and the clumps dissolve into individuals, I noticed Teresa Grass and Morgan Dell already starting across the lawn toward the street. They're each walking with their families, heads down, without once looking back. They haven't been celebrating with us, I realize. And it occurs to me I haven't seen Eleanor Rana or Annie Hahn or the other Cureds either. They must have already gone home. A curious ache throbs in the back of my throat. Even though, of course, this is how things are. Everything ends, people move on, they don't look back. It's how they should be. I catch sight of Rachel through the crowd and go running up to her, suddenly eager to be next to her, wishing she would reach down and ruffle my hair like she used to when I was very little and say, "Good job, Looney," her old nickname for me. "Rachel!" I'm breathless for no reason and I have trouble squeezing the words out. I'm so happy to see her, I feel like I could burst into tears. I don't, though, obviously. "You came!" "Of course I came." She smiles at me. "You're my only sister, remember?" She passes me a bouquet of daisies she has brought with her, loosely wrapped in brown paper. "Congratulations, Lena." I stick my face in the flowers and inhale, trying to fight down the urge to reach out and hug her. For a second, we just stand there, blinking at each other, and then she reaches out to me. I'm sure she's going to put her arms around me for old time's sake, or at the very least, give me a one-armed squeeze. Instead, she just flicks a bang off my forehead. "Gross," she says, still smiling. "You're all sweaty." It's stupid and immature to feel disappointed, but I do. "It's the gown," I say, and realize that yes, that must be the problem. The gown is what's choking me, stifling me, making it hard to breathe. "Come on," she says. "Aunt Carol will want to congratulate you." Aunt Carol is standing at the field's periphery with my uncle, Grace, and Jenny, talking to Mrs. Springer, my history teacher. I fall into step beside Rachel. She's only a few inches taller than I am, and we walk together, in sync but separated by 3 feet of space. She's quiet. I can tell she's already wondering when she can go home and get on with her life. I let myself look back once. I can't help it. I watch the girls circulating in their orange gowns like flames. Everything seems to zoom back, recede away at once. All the voices intermingle and become indistinguishable from one another, like the constant white noise of the ocean running underneath the rhythm of the Portland streets, so constant you hardly notice it. Everything looks stark and vivid and frozen, as though drawn precisely and outlined in ink. Parents' smiles frozen, camera flashes blinding, mouths open and white teeth glistening, dark glossy hair and deep blue sky and unrelenting light. Everyone drowning in light. Everything so clear and perfect, I'm sure it must already be a memory. Or a dream. Chapter 8. H is for hydrogen, a weight of one. When fissions split, as brightly lit, as hot as any sun. HE is for helium, a weight of two, the noble gas, the ghostly pass, that lifts a world anew. LI is for lithium, a weight of three, a funeral pyre, when touched with fire, and deadly sleep for me. BE is for beryllium, a weight of four. From the Elemental Prayers, Prayer and Study, the Book of Shh. During the summers, I have to help my uncle at the Stop and Save on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Saturdays, mostly stocking shelves and working behind the deli counter and occasionally helping with filing and accounting in the little office behind the cereal and dry goods aisle. Thankfully, in late June, Andrew Marcus gets cured and reassigned to a permanent position at another grocery store. On the 4th of July, I head to Hannah's house in the morning. Every year we go to see the fireworks at the Eastern Promenade. A band is always playing and vendors set up their carts, selling fried meat on skewers and corn on the cob and apple pie floating in a puddle of ice cream served in little paper boats. The 4th of July, the day of our independence, the day we commemorate the closing of our nation's border forever, is one of my favorite holidays. I love the music that pipes through the streets, love the way the steam rising thick from the grills makes the streets look cloudy, the people shadowy and unclear. I especially love the temporary extension of curfew. Instead of being home at 9 o'clock, all uncureds are allowed to stay out until 11. In recent years, Hannah and I have made it a kind of game to stay out until the last possible second, cutting it closer and closer every year. Last year, I stepped into the house at 10:58 exactly, heart hammering in my chest, shaking with exhaustion. I had to sprint home. But as I lay in bed, I couldn't stop grinning. I felt like I'd gotten away with something. I type in Hannah's 4-digit gate code. She gave it to me in 8th grade, saying it was a sign of trust, and also that she'd slit me from the top of the head to the heels if I shared it with anyone else, and slip in through the front door. I never bother knocking. Her parents are hardly ever home, and Hannah never answers the door. I'm pretty much the only person who comes over to see her. It's weird. Hannah was always really popular in school. People looked up to her and wanted to be like her. But even though she was really friendly with everybody, she never really got close with anyone besides me. Sometimes I wonder whether she wishes she'd been assigned a different desk partner in Mrs. Jablonski's 2nd grade class, which is how we first became friends. Hannah's last name is Tate, and we were linked up by alphabetical order. By then I was already going by my aunt's last name, Tittle. I wonder whether she wishes she'd been placed with Rebecca Trelawney or Katie Scarp or even Melissa Portofino. Sometimes I feel like she deserves a best friend who is just a little more special. Once Hannah told me that she likes me because I'm for real, because I really feel things. But that's the whole problem, how much I feel things. Hello, I call out as soon as I'm inside Hannah's house. The front hall is dark and cool as always. Goosebumps prick up over my arms. No matter how many times I come to Hannah's house, I'm always shocked by the power of the air conditioning, which hums somewhere deep inside the walls. For a moment, I just stand there, inhaling the clean smells of furniture polish and Windex and fresh-cut flowers. Music is pulsing from Hannah's room upstairs. I try to identify the song, but can't make out any words, just bass throbbing through the floorboards. At the top of the stairs, I pause. Hannah's bedroom door is closed. I definitely don't recognize the song she's playing, or blasting, really, so loud I have to remind myself that Hannah's house is shielded on 4 sides by trees and lawn, and no one will stick the regulators on her. It's not like any music I've ever heard. It's a shrieky, shrill, fierce kind of music. I can't even tell whether the singer is male or female. Little fingers of electricity creep up my spine, a feeling I used to have when I was a tiny child, when I would creep into the kitchen and try to sneak an extra cookie from the pantry. The feeling right before the creak and squeak of my mom's footsteps in the kitchen behind me, when I would whirl around, my hands and face coated in crumbs, guilty. I shake off the feeling and push open Hannah's door. She's sitting at her computer, feet propped up on her desk, bobbing her head and tapping out a rhythm on her thighs. As soon as she sees me, she swings forward and hits a key on her keyboard. The music cuts off instantly. Strangely, the silence that follows seems just as loud. She flips her hair over one shoulder and scoots away from the desk. Something flickers over her face, an expression that passes too quickly for me to identify it. Hi, she chirrups, a little too cheerfully. Didn't hear you come in. I doubt you would have heard me break in. I go over to her bed and collapse on top of it. Hannah has a queen-size bed with 3 down pillows. It's like heaven. What was that? What was what? She lifts her knees to her chest and swivels a full circle in her chair. I sit up on my elbows and watch her. Hannah only acts this dumb when she's hiding something. The music? She still stares at me blankly. The song you were blasting when I came in, the one that almost burst my eardrums? Oh, that. Hannah blows her bangs out of her face. This is another one of her tells. Whenever she's bluffing in poker, she won't stop fussing with her bangs. Just some new band I found online. On LAMM? I press. Hannah's music-obsessed and used to spend hours surfing LAMM, the library of authorized music and movies when we were in middle school. Hannah looks away. Not exactly. What do you mean, not exactly? The intranet, like everything else in the United States, is controlled and monitored for our protection. All the websites, all the content is written by government agencies, including the list of authorized entertainment, which gets updated biannually. Digital books go into the LAB, the Library of Approved Books, Movies and music go into LAMM, and for a small fee, you can download them to your computer. If you have one, that is. I don't. Hannah sighs, keeping her eyes averted. Finally, she looks at me. Can you keep a secret? Now I sit up all the way, scooting to the edge of the bed. I don't like the way she's looking at me. I don't trust it. What is this about, Hannah? Can you keep a secret? She repeats. I think of standing with her in front of the labs on evaluation day, the sun beating down on us, the way she forced her mouth close to my ear to whisper about happiness and unhappiness. I'm suddenly afraid for her. Of her. But I nod and say, yeah, of course. Okay. She looks down, fiddles with the hem of her shorts for a second, takes a deep breath. So, last week, I met this guy. What? I nearly fall off the bed. Relax! She holds up a hand. He's cured, okay? He works for the city. He's a censor, actually. My heartbeat slows and I settle back against her pillows again. Okay. So? Hannah says, drawing the word out. He was waiting at the doctor's with me when I went to have my PT, you know? Hannah sprained her ankle in the fall and still has to do physical therapy once a week to keep it strong. And we started talking. She pauses. I don't really see where the story is going or how it relates to the music she was playing, so I just wait for her to go on. Finally, she does. Anyway, I was telling him about boards and how I really want to go to USM, and he was telling me about his job, what he does, you know, day to day. He codes the online access restrictions, so people can't just write whatever or post things themselves or write up false information or inflammatory opinions. She puts this in quotes, rolling her eyes, and other stuff like that. He's like an intranet security guard. Okay, I say again. I want to tell Hannah to get to the point. I know all about online security restrictions. Everybody does. But that would just make her clam up. She sucks in a deep breath. But he doesn't just code the security. He checks for lapses, like break-ins. Hackers, basically, who jump through all the security hoops and manage to post their own stuff. The government calls them floaters. Websites that might be up for an hour or a day or 2 days before they're discovered. Websites full of unauthorized stuff. Opinions and message boards and video clips and music. And you found one? A sick feeling has settled in my stomach. Words keep flashing in my brain like a neon sign going in and out. Illegal. Interrogation. Surveillance. Hannah. She doesn't seem to notice that I've gone totally still. Her face is suddenly animated, as alive and energetic as I've ever seen it, and she leans forward on her knees, talking in a rush. Not just one. Dozens. There are tons of them out there, if you know how to look. If you know where to look. It's incredible, Lena. All these people, they must be all over the country, sneaking in through the loops and the holes. You should see some of the things people write about the cure. It's not just the invalids who don't believe in it. There are people here, all over the place, who don't think. I'm staring at her so hard, she drops her eyes and switches topics. And you should hear the music. Incredible, amazing music, like nothing you've ever heard. Music that almost takes your head off, you know? That makes you want to scream and jump up and down and break stuff and cry. Hannah's room is big, almost twice as big as my room at home, but I feel as though the walls are pressing down around me. If the air conditioning's still working, I can no longer feel it. The air feels hot and heavy, like a wet breath, and I stand up and move to the window. Hannah breaks off, finally. I try to shove open her window, but it won't budge. I push and strain against the windowsill. Lena, Hannah says timidly after a minute. It won't open. All I can think is I need air. The rest of my thoughts are a blur of radio static and fluorescent lights and lab coats and steel tables and surgical knives. An image of Willow Marks getting dragged off to the lab screaming, her house defaced with marker and paint. Lena, Hannah says louder now. Come on! It's stuck. Wood must be warped from the heat if it would just open. I heave and the window flies upward finally. There's a popping sound, and the latch that's been keeping it in place snaps off and skitters to the middle of the floor. For a second, Hannah and I both stand there, staring at it. The air coming in the open window doesn't make me feel better. It's even hotter outside. Sorry, I mumble. I can't look at her. I didn't mean to. I didn't know it was locked. The windows at my house don't lock. Don't worry about the window. I don't care about the stupid window. One time Grace got out of her crib when she was little, almost made it onto the roof, just slid the window right open and started climbing. Lena. Hannah reaches out and grabs my shoulders. I don't know if I have a fever or what, going hot and cold every 5 seconds, but her touch makes a chill go through me and I pull away quickly. You're mad at me. I'm not mad. I'm worried about you. But that's only half true. I am mad. Furious, in fact. All this time, I've been blindly coasting along, the idiot sidekick, thinking about our last real summer together, stressing about the matches I'll get, and evaluations and boards and normal stuff, and she's been nodding and smiling and saying, yeah, me too, and I'm sure things will be fine, and meanwhile, behind my back, she's been turning into someone I don't know. Someone with secrets and weird habits and opinions about things we're not even supposed to think about. Now I know why I was so startled on evaluation day when she turned back to whisper to me, eyes huge and glowing. It was like she had dropped away for a second. My best friend. My only real friend. And in her place was a stranger. That's what's been happening all this time. Hannah has been morphing into a stranger. I turn back to the window. A sharp blade of sadness goes through me, deep and quick. I guess it was bound to happen eventually. I've always known it would. Everyone you trust, everyone you think you can count on, will eventually disappoint you. When left to their own devices, people lie and keep secrets and change and disappear, some behind a different face or personality, some behind a dense early morning fog beyond a cliff. That's why the cure is so important. That's why we need it. Listen, I'm not gonna get arrested just for looking at some websites or listening to music or whatever. You could. People have been arrested for less. She knows this too. She knows and doesn't care. Yeah, well, I'm sick of it. Hannah's voice trembles a little, which throws me. I've never heard her sound less than certain. We shouldn't even be talking about this. Someone could be listening. She cuts me off, finishes my sentence for me. God, Lena, I'm sick of that too, aren't you? Sick of always checking your back, looking behind you, watching what you say, think, do. I can't breathe. I can't sleep. I can't move. I feel like there are walls everywhere. Everywhere I go, bam, there's a wall. Everything I want, bam, another wall. She rakes a hand through her hair. For once, she doesn't look pretty and in control. She looks pale and unhappy, and her expression reminds me of something, but I can't place it right away. It's for our own protection, I say, wishing I sounded more confident. I've never been good in a fight. Everything will get better once we're... Again, she jumps in. Once we're cured? She laughs, a short barking sound with no humor in it, but at least she doesn't contradict me directly. Right, yeah, that's what everybody says. All of a sudden, it hits me. She reminds me of the animals we saw once on a class trip to the slaughterhouse. All the cows were lined up, packed in their stalls, staring at us mutely as we walked by, with that same look in their eyes. Fear and resignation and something else. Desperation. I'm really scared then, truly terrified for her. But when she speaks again, she sounds a little bit calmer. Maybe it will. Get better. I mean, once we're cured. But until then, this is our last chance, Lena. Our last chance to do anything. Our last chance to choose. There's the word from evaluation day again. Choose. But I nod because I don't want to set her off again. So, what are you going to do? She looks away, biting her lip, and I can tell she's debating whether or not to trust me. There's... this party tonight? What? Zoom. The fear floods back in. She rushes on. It's something I found on one of the floaters. It's a music thing. A few bands playing out by the border in Stroudwater on one of the farms. You can't be serious. You're not actually going, right? You're not even thinking about it. It's safe, okay? I promise. These websites, it's really amazing, Lena. I swear you'd be into it if you looked. They're hidden. Links, usually embedded on normal pages, approved government stuff, but I don't know, somehow you can tell they don't feel right, you know? They don't belong. I grasp at a single word. Safe? How can it be safe? That guy you met, the censor, his whole job is to track down people who are stupid enough to post these things. They're not stupid. They are incredibly smart, actually. Not to mention the regulators and patrols and the youth guard and curfew and segregation and just about everything else that makes this one of the worst ideas. Fine. Hannah raises her arms and brings them slapping down against her thighs. The noise is so loud it makes me jump. Fine. So it's a bad idea. So it's risky. You know what? I don't care. For a second, there's silence. We're glaring at each other, and the air between us feels charged and dangerous, a thin electrical coil ready to explode. What about me? I say finally, struggling to keep my voice from shaking. You're welcome to come. 10:30, Roaring Brook Farms, Stroudwater, music, dancing, you know, fun. The stuff we're supposed to be having before they cut out half of our brain. I ignore the last part of her comment. I don't think so, Hannah. In case you've forgotten, we have other plans for tonight. Have had plans for tonight for, the past 15 years? Yeah, well, things change. She turns her back to me, but I feel like she's reached out and punched me in the stomach. Fine. My throat is squeezing up. This time I know it's the real deal, and I'm on the verge of crying. I go over to her bed and start gathering up my stuff. Of course, my bag has spilled over on its side, and now her comforter is covered with little scraps of paper and gum wrappers and coins and pens. I start stuffing these back into my bag, fighting back the tears. Go ahead. Do whatever you want tonight. I don't care. Maybe Hannah feels bad because her voice softens a little bit. Seriously, Lena, you should think about coming. We won't get in any trouble, I promise. You can't promise that. I take a deep breath, wishing my voice would stop quivering. You don't know that. You can't be positive. And you can't go on being so scared all the time. That's it. That does it. I whirl around, furious, something deep and black and old rising inside of me. Of course I'm scared, and I'm right to be scared. And if you're not scared, it's just because you have the perfect little life and the perfect little family, and for you, everything is perfect, perfect, perfect. You don't see, you don't know. Perfect? That's what you think? You think my life is perfect? Her voice is quiet but full of anger. I'm tempted to move away from her but force myself to stay put. Yeah, I do. Again, she lets out a barking laugh, a quick explosion. So you think this is it, huh? As good as it gets? She turns a full circle, arms extended like she's embracing the room, the house, everything. Her question startles me. What else is there? Everything, Lena! She shakes her head. Listen, I'm not gonna apologize. I know you have your reasons for being scared. What happened to your mom was terrible. Don't bring my mom into this. My body goes tight, electric. But you can't go on blaming her for everything. She died more than 10 years ago. Anger swallows me, a thick fog. My mind careens wildly like wheels over ice, bumping up against random words. Fear, blame, don't forget. Mom, I love you. And now I see that Hannah is a snake, has been waiting a long time to say this to me, has been waiting to squirm her way in, as deep and painful as she can go and bite. Fuck you. In the end, these are the two words that come. She holds up both hands. Listen, Lena, I'm just saying you have to let it go. You're nothing like her, and you're not gonna end up like her. You don't have it in you. Fuck you. She's trying to be nice, but my mind is closed up and the words come out on their own, cascading over one another, and I wish every single one was a punch so that I could hit her in the face. Bam, 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 bam. You don't know a single thing about her, and you don't know me. You don't know anything. Lena, She reaches for me. Don't touch me! I'm stumbling backward, grabbing my bag, bumping against her desk as I move toward the door. My vision is cloudy. I can barely make out the banisters. I'm tripping, half falling down the stairs, finding the front door by touch. I think Hannah might be calling to me, but everything is lost to a roaring, rushing in my ears, inside my head. Sunshine, brilliant, brilliant white light, cool, biting iron under my fingers, the gate, ocean smells, gasoline, wailing, growing louder, a punctuated shriek, beep, beep, beep. My head clears all at once, and I jump out of the middle of the street just before I'm squashed by a police car which barrels past me, horn still blaring, siren whirling, leaving me coughing up dirt and dust. The ache in my throat gets so bad it feels like I'm gagging, and when I finally let the tears come, it's a huge relief, like dropping something heavy after you've been carrying it for a long time. Once I start crying, I can't stop. And all the way home, I have to keep mashing my palm into my eyes every few seconds, smearing away the tears just so I can see where I'm going. I comfort myself by thinking that in less than 2 months, this will seem like nothing to me. All of it will fall away and I'll rise up new and free, like a bird winging up into the air. That's what Hannah doesn't understand, has never understood. For some of us, it's about more than the deliria. Some of us, the lucky ones, will get the chance to be reborn. Newer, fresher, better. Healed and whole and perfect again like a misshapen slab of iron that comes out of the fire, glowing, glittering, razor sharp. That is all I want. All I have ever wanted. That is the promise of the cure. Chapter 9. Lord, keep our hearts fixed. As you fixed the planets in their orbits and cooled the chaos of emerging, as the gravity of your will keeps star and star from collapsing, keeps ocean from turning to dust and dust from turning to water, keeps planets from colliding and suns from exploding, so, Lord, keep our hearts fixed in steady orbit and help them stay the path. Psalm 21, from Prayer and Study, the Book of That night, even after I'm in bed, Hannah's words replay themselves endlessly in my head. You won't end up like her. You don't have it in you. She only said it to comfort me. I know it should be reassuring, but for some reason it isn't. For some reason it makes me upset. There's a deep aching in my chest, as though something large and cold and sharp is lodged there. Here's another thing Hannah doesn't understand. Thinking about the disease and worrying about it and stressing about whether I've inherited some predisposition for it, that's all I have of my mom. The disease is what I know about her. It is the link. Otherwise, I have nothing. It's not that I don't have memories of her. I do, lots of them, considering how young I was when she died. I remember that when there was fresh snow, she would send me outside to pack pans with handfuls of it. Once inside, we would drizzle maple syrup into the snow-filled pans, watching it harden into amber candy almost instantly. All loops and fragile, sugared filigree, like edible lace. I remember how much she loved to sing to us as she bounced me in the water at the beach off Eastern Prom. I didn't know how strange this was at the time. Other mothers teach their children to swim. Other mothers bounce their babies in the water and apply sunscreen to make sure their babies don't burn and do all the things that a mother is supposed to do as outlined in the parenting section of the Book of But they don't sing. I remember that she brought me trays of buttered toast when I was sick and kissed my bruises when I fell. And I remember once when she lifted me to my feet after I fell off my bike and began to rock me in her arms, a woman gasped and said to her, "You should be ashamed of yourself." And I didn't understand why, which made me cry harder. After that, she comforted me only in private. In public, she would just frown and say, "You're okay, Lena, get up." We used to have dance parties, too. My mother called them sock jams, because we would roll up the carpets in the living room and put on our thickest socks and slip and slide along the wooden hallways. Even Rachel joined in, though she always claimed to be too old for baby games. My mom would draw the curtains and wedge pillows under the front and back doors and turn up the music. We laughed so hard I always went to bed with a stomach ache. Eventually, I understood that on our sock jam nights, she'd close the curtains to prevent us from being seen by passing patrols, that she'd stopped up the doors with pillows so that the neighbors would not report us for playing music and laughing too much, both potential warning signs of the deliria. I understood that she used to tuck my father's military pin, a silver dagger he had inherited from his own father, which she wore every day on a chain around her neck, beneath the collar of her shirt whenever we left the house, so no one would see it and become suspicious. I understood that all the happiest moments of my childhood were a lie. They were wrong and unsafe and illegal. They were freakish. My mother was freakish, and I'd probably inherited the freakishness from her. For the first time, really, I wonder what she must have been feeling, thinking, the night she walked out to the cliffs and kept walking, feet pedaling the air. I wonder whether she was scared. I wonder whether she thought of me or Rachel. I wonder whether she was sorry for leaving us behind. I start thinking about my father, too. I don't remember him at all, though I have some dim, ancient impression of two warm, rough hands and a large, looming face floating above mine. But I think that's just because my mother kept a framed portrait in her bedroom of my father and me. I was only a few months old, and he was holding me, smiling, looking at the camera. But there's no way I'm remembering for real, real. I wasn't even a year old when he died. Cancer. The heat is horrible, thick, clotting on the walls. Jenny is rolled over on her back, arms and legs flung open on top of her comforter, breathing silently with her mouth gaping open. Even Grace is fast asleep, murmuring soundlessly into her pillow. The whole room smells like a wet exhalation, skin and tongues and warm milk. I ease out of bed, already dressed in black jeans and a t-shirt. I didn't even bother to change into my pajamas. I knew I would never be able to sleep tonight. And earlier in the evening, I'd come to a decision. I was sitting at the dinner table with Carol and Uncle William and Jenny and Grace, while everyone chewed and swallowed in silence, staring blankly at one another, feeling as though the air was weighing down on me, constricting my breath like two fists squeezing tighter and tighter around a water balloon, when I realized something. Hannah said I didn't have it in me, but she was wrong. My heart is beating so loudly I can hear it, and I'm positive that everyone else will too, that it will make my aunt sit bolt upright in her bed, ready to catch me and accuse me of trying to sneak out. Which is, of course, exactly what I am trying to do. I didn't even know a heart could beat so loudly, and it reminds me of an Edgar Allan Poe story we had to read in one of our social studies classes, about this guy who kills this other guy and then gives himself up to the police because he's convinced he can hear the dead guy's heart beating up from beneath his floorboards. It's supposed to be a story about guilt and the dangers of civil disobedience, but when I first read it, I thought it seemed kind of lame and melodramatic. Now I get it, though. Poe must have snuck out a lot when he was young. I ease open the bedroom door, holding my breath, praying it doesn't squeak. At one point, Jenny lets out a shout and my heart freezes. But then she rolls over, flinging one arm across her pillow, and I exhale slowly, realizing she's just fussing in her sleep. The hall is totally dark. The room my aunt and uncle share is dark, too. And the only sound comes from the whispering of the trees outside and the low ticks and groans from the walls, the usual old house arthritic noises. I finally work up the courage to slip out into the hall and slide the bedroom door shut behind me. I go so slowly that it almost feels like I'm not moving at all, feeling my way by the bumps and ripples in the wallpaper over to the stairs, then sliding my hand inch by inch over the banister, walking on my very tiptoes. Even so, it seems like the house is fighting me, like it's just screaming for me to be caught. Every step seems to creak or shriek or moan. Every single floorboard quivers and shudders under my feet, and I start mentally bargaining with the house. If I make it to the front door without waking up Aunt Carol, I swear to God I'll never slam another door. I'll never call you an old piece of turd again, not even in my head, and I'll never curse the basement when it floods, and I will never, ever, ever kick the bedroom wall when I'm annoyed at Jenny. Maybe the house hears me because, miraculously, I do make it to the front door. I pause for a second longer, listening for the sounds of footsteps upstairs, whispered voices, anything. But other than my heart, which is still going strong and loud. It's silent. Even the house seems to hesitate and take a breath, because the front door swings open with barely a whisper, and in the last second before I slip out into the night, the rooms behind me are as dark and still as a grave. Outside, I hesitate on the front stoop. The fireworks stopped an hour ago. I heard the last stuttering explosions like distant gunfire just as I was getting ready for bed. And now the streets are strangely silent and totally empty. It's a little after 11 o'clock. Some Cureds must be lingering at the Eastern Prom. Everyone else is home by now. Not a single light is burning on the street. All the street lamps were disabled years ago, except in the richest parts of Portland, and they look to me like blinded eyes. Thank God the moon is so bright. I strain to detect the sounds of passing patrols or groups of regulators. I almost hope I do, because then I'll have to go back inside to my bed, to safety. And already the panic is starting to drill through me again. But everything is perfectly still and quiet, almost like it's frozen. Everything rational, right, and good is screaming for me to turn around and go upstairs, but some stubborn inner center keeps me moving forward. I go down the walk and unchain my bike from the gate. My bike rattles a little bit, particularly when you first start pedaling, so I walk it a ways down the street. The wheels tick reassuringly over the pavement. I've never been out this late on my own in my life. I've never broken curfew. But alongside the fear, which is always there, of course, that constant crushing weight, is a small flickering feeling of excitement that works its way up and underneath the fear, pushing it back some. Like, it's okay. I'm all right. I can do this. I'm just a girl, an in-between girl, 5'2", nothing special, but I can do this. And all the curfews and the patrols in the world aren't stopping me. It's amazing how much comfort this thought gives me. It's amazing how it breaks up the fear, like a tiny candle lit in the middle of the night, lighting up the shapes of things, burning away the dark. When I reach the end of my street, I hop up on my bike, feeling the gears shudder into place. The breeze feels good as I start pedaling, careful not to go too quickly, staying alert in case there are regulators nearby. Fortunately, Stroudwater and Roaring Brook Farms are in the exact opposite direction from the 4th of July celebrations at Eastern Prom. Once I get to the broad swath of farmland that surrounds Portland like a belt, I should be okay. The farms and slaughterhouses rarely get patrolled. But first I have to make it through the West End, where rich people like Hannah live, through Libby Town and over the Four River at the Congress Street Bridge. Thankfully, each street I turn down is empty. Stroudwater is a good 30 minutes away, even if I'm biking quickly. As I get off Peninsula, moving away from the buildings and businesses of downtown Portland and onto the more suburban mainland, the houses get smaller and farther apart, set back on weedy, patchy yards. This isn't rural Portland yet, but there are signs of the countryside creeping in. Plants poking up through half-rotted porches, an owl hooting mournfully in the dark, a black scythe of bats cutting suddenly across the sky. Almost all these houses have cars in front of them, just like the richer houses in West End, but these have obviously been salvaged from the junkyards. They're mounted on cinder blocks and covered in rust. I pass one that has a tree growing straight through its sunroof, like the car has just dropped out of the sky and been impaled there, and another one, hood open, missing its engine. As I go past, a cat startles up out of its black cavity, meowing, blinking at me. After I cross the Four River, the houses fall away altogether, and it's just field after field and farm after farm, with names like Meadow Lane and Sheep's Bay and Willow Creek, which make them sound all homey and nice, places where someone might be baking muffins and skimming fresh cream for butter. But most of the farms are owned by big corporations, packed with livestock and often staffed by orphans. I've always liked it out here, but it's kind of freaky in the dark, open and totally empty, and I can't help but think that if I did come across a patrol, there would be no place to hide, no alley to turn down. Across the fields, I see the low, dark silhouettes of barns and silos, some of them brand new, some of them barely standing, clinging to the earth like teeth digging into something. The air smells slightly sweet, like growing things in manure. Roaring Brook Farms is right next to the southwestern border. It's been abandoned for years, since half the main building and both grain silos were destroyed in a fire. About 5 minutes before I get there, I think I can make out a rhythm drumming almost imperceptibly under the throaty song of the crickets. But for a while, I'm not sure if I'm just imagining it or only hearing my heart, which has started pounding again. Farther on, though, and I'm sure. Even before I reach the little dirt road that leads down to the barn, or at least the portion of the barn that's still standing, strains of music spring up, crystallizing in the night air like rain turning suddenly to snow, drifting to earth. Now I'm scared again. All I can think is wrong, 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 a word that drums in my head. Aunt Carol would kill me if she knew what I was doing. Kill me, or have me thrown into the crypts, or taken to the labs for an early procedure, Willowmark style. I hop off my bike when I see the turn off to Roaring Brook, and the big metal sign staked in the ground that reads, Property of Portland, no trespassing. I wheel my bike a little ways into the woods at the side of the road. The actual farmhouse and the old barn are still 500 or 600 feet down the road, but I don't want to bring my bike any farther. I don't lock it up, though. I don't even want to think about what would happen if there was a raid, but if there is, I'm not going to want to be fumbling with a lock in the half dark. I'll need speed. I step around the no trespassing sign. I'm getting to be quite the expert at ignoring them, I realize, remembering how Hannah and I hopped the gate at the labs. It's the first time I've thought about that afternoon in a while. And right then, a vision of Alex rises up in front of me, a memory of seeing him on the observation deck, head tilted back and laughing. I have to focus on the land around me, the brightness of the moon, the wildflowers on the road. It helps me beat back the feeling that I'm going to be sick at any second. I don't really know what compelled me out of the house, why I felt like I had to prove Hannah wrong about something. And I'm trying to ignore the idea, way more disturbing than anything else, that my argument with Hannah was just an excuse. That maybe, deep down, I was just curious. I'm not feeling curious now. I'm feeling scared. And very, very stupid. The farmhouse and the old barn are positioned in a dip of land between two hills, a mini valley, like the buildings are sitting right in the middle of somebody's pursed lips. Because of the way the land slopes, I can't see the farmhouse yet, but as I get closer to the top of the hill, the music gets clearer, louder. It's like nothing I've ever heard before. It's definitely not like the authorized music you can download off LAMM, prim and harmonious and structured, the kind of music that gets played in the band shell in Deering Oaks Park during official summer concerts. Someone is singing. A beautiful voice as thick and heavy as warm honey, spilling up and down a scale so quickly I feel dizzy just listening. The music that's playing underneath the voice is strange and clashing and wild, but nothing like the wailing and scratching that I heard Hannah playing on her computer earlier today. Though I recognize certain similarities, certain patterns of melody and rhythm. That music was metallic and awful, fuzzy through the speakers. This music ebbs and flows, irregular, sad. It reminds me, weirdly, of watching the ocean during a bad storm. The lashing, crashing waves and the spray of sea foam against the docks. The way it takes your breath away. The power and the hugeness of it. That's exactly what happens as I listen to the music, as I come up over the final crest of hill and the half-ruined barn and collapsing farmhouse fan out in front of me, just as the music swells, a wave about to break. The breath leaves my